FOMO.
My inclination when people ask me about how to formulate an interesting career is I always just encourage them to go back to the first principles that get them excited every morning and out of bed and enthusiastic about something. And for me, that's like, who are the people? What is the problem that we're solving together?
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis, and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out. And it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. FOMO. FOMO. Welcome back to FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. I'm your host, Patrick J. McGinnis, and today we're talking to Tom Conrad. Now, Tom started his career as an engineer at Apple, rose to the CTO of Pandora and VP of product at Snapchat, and serves on the board of Sonos, which, by the way, mine's broken right now, so he can help me fix it during this wonderful interview, right? He's also navigated notorious flops, including Pets.com and Quibi, and now as the CEO of Zero, a digital intermittent fasting coach that improves metabolic health. He's applying his 30-plus years of leadership and product experience to drive innovation and user engagement. With nearly 14 million users and 12.5 million raised, Zero is just scratching the surface of the wellness revolution to come. Welcome, Tom Conrad.
It's so great to be on.
All right, Tom. So as you know, I like to start every interview with the same question. And even guys with fancy apps that improve people's health do not escape me. So the question is this. Tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
Well, it's super connected to the work that I'm doing today. If we go back to the pandemic, I was not a healthy person. I had sort of yo-yo dieted and seen my weight go up and down all through my life. But it had mostly been vanity that was the catalyst for losing weight through the years. But in 2020, for the first time, I was starting to feel like the actual sort of health impact of being overweight. Out of breath, climbing a flight of stairs, just, you know, not sleeping well, just feeling bad. And so I used the moment of the pandemic to go kind of really deep on this question of like, what are the things that you can do to live a longer and healthier life? And I hoped that I was going to discover that there was some sort of secret off-label pharmaceutical intervention. You know, I could take rapamycin or one of these things that you read about, you know, people experimenting with at the cutting edge to sort of give me another 5 or 10 years. So I did all the things. I had a continuous glucose monitor and concierge doctor to give me advice and like a million podcasts and YouTube videos on the topic, an Oura ring, you know, all of the things. And on the other side of all of that, the thing that just became incredibly clear is the best thing that you can do to live a longer and healthier life is become a great steward of your metabolism. And stewardship of your metabolism is really about a handful of healthy habits that anybody can adopt for life. So, you know, that's intermittent fasting, that zone 2 exercise, that sleep hygiene, that stress management. And there are tools for all of those things. And so I cobbled together sort of a protocol around those things and really reversed my health, lost a bunch of weight, improved my hemoglobin A1C. I sleep better, I feel better, I have more energy, I'm not out of breath climbing stairs anymore. And the big thing that happened, the thing that really changed my life, is it sort of transformed my identity from like an unhealthy person to now I think of myself as a healthy person. And you know, not a biohacker, not an extreme sports enthusiast, but definitely a healthy person. And so it's been really, really rewarding over the course of the last 3 years to take all of that I've learned and apply it to my professional life as well, and the things we're doing at Zero.
That's such a strong reframe. I love it. And listen, I get you. I listeners to the show know that as a kid, I lost like 50 pounds in high school. And so I had to sort of retrain myself to think of myself as somebody who was, you know, and I made a lot of changes as well, somebody who was healthy from being unhealthy or whatever. Just like in your head, you're always going to be the you from before. And then that's very self-limiting and can be, especially if it creates all this stuff for you. And so one of my little tricks over the years, which we haven't talked about yet, is that I do intermittent fasting. I've been doing it since, I mean, I can't remember the last, it's been like at least 7 years or something. And it's been very, I probably haven't been as hardcore as some people, but it's been just, it kind of already fit in my lifestyle. I never really ate. And I was like, I can't eat in the morning. I don't know why. So anyway, it's something that I had heard about years ago and I started practicing. And of course, now a lot of people are doing it. And certainly there's a lot of conversation. So we're going to talk about that today. We're going to get into Zero and what you're building there. But I want to start out because you're one of the people who comes on the show where I'm reading through your LinkedIn and I'm like, I know all the companies, you know, it's, we heard it, Apple and Pandora and Snapchat and Pets.com and Quibi, all companies that, you know, were pretty incredible. And you've been on the product side of those in a lot of times or on the tech side of those. So you really, you know, you kind of got this incredible trajectory that you have followed that is really special. So I just want to start there. I want to start first with the highlights. Like, tell me about the things that you learned and, you know, those successful enterprise. I know it's a lot, but, you know, if you could distill it down to one or two things that were really critical learnings that you had in those firms.
You know, we should certainly start with Pandora because it was, you know, it's going to be hard to ever really, I think, recreate the incredibly special sort of thing that happened with that company. And I guess maybe just the first thing to say about it is the company that I joined was a 7 or 8 person little startup called Savage Beast Technologies. Mm. They made a API that other companies could invoke to make music recommendations inside of their products. So AOL was a customer, Best Buy was a customer, Borders Books was a customer. And they were looking for kind of a engineering manager to just do day-to-day project management of the software development process for this you know, B2B2C kind of a platform. And for a bunch of reasons, that was not what I was interested in. But I really liked the people and I really liked the domain. I've always been really, really passionate about music and music discovery. I was the kid in college that would park you in front of my stereo and force you to listen to things that I thought you might like. And so I took this job, despite having reservations about the B2B2C nature of it and the particular role, which is very narrow and focused on sort of the tactical aspects of executing. And first thing that happens within 90 days, the technical co-founder and product leader had departed the company, not in a very dramatic way, but left this vacuum around product leadership that I was able to step into along with a new CEO who had joined just a couple of weeks after I. And the two of us, along with Tim Westergren and a woman named Jessica Steele, did all of the sort of initial thinking that led to the creation of Pandora. And so I mostly tell that story because it was just luck. Mm. I sort of stumbled into this incredible opportunity that was a career-defining thing for me. And if we were to go through the whole story of what I've done professionally, that aspect of luck would just kind of happen over and over and over again. And so my inclination when people ask me about how to formulate an interesting career is I always just encourage them to go back to the first principles that get them excited every morning and out of bed and enthusiastic about something. And for me, that's like, who are the people? What is the problem that we're solving together? And so Pandora was a great example of that. I found a great set of people that were like roughly in the zip code that I cared about. And just a bunch of incredible things happened as I, you know, worked with that team to apply all of our skills to creating something interesting. FOMO.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, or delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. And with rising prices everywhere you look, you gotta do the math and save money. Good news, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. So head over to netsuite.com/FOMO. That's netsuite.com/FOMO. netsuite.com/FOMO. Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now that right there was Portuguese, and as you know, I love speaking foreign languages. But I'm not alone. One in five Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak four languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply.
FOMO.
Yeah, people forget. I mean, Pandora at the time, now you're like, oh, you know, digital radio, yay. Like, but at the time, it was people, it blew all of our minds. I remember going to like my, you know, my, I get a haircut and they would have great music. It's like, what do you, where did you get that? Oh, it's Pandora. Like, oh my God, like this is, the future has arrived. So it went public. I mean, it was a big deal. Now, I do want to talk about another media play that you did that blew up, which is Quibi. And, you know, because you did Pets.com, but Pets.com, that was like the whole internet market in 99, 2000 blew up. Pets.com had a, you know, a famous mascot, so it kind of got a lot of press and it was kind of cheeky. But that was, you know, it wasn't like an outlier. Quibi raised a tremendous amount of money. It had Meg Whitman involved, Jeffrey Katzenberg. It was supposed to be the future of television. It was right before the pandemic, if I'm correct about that. It was short form content. And it was like, I'm sure when you got that job, you were like, holy mackerel, like this is going to I'm going to be buying 19 houses with whatever, you know, when this thing sells. But then it blew up in spectacular fashion. And I think the assets were kind of sold off to different people. Talk about that experience. Number one, you know, I'd love to know, like, going in, did you see the seeds for its sort of eventual failure? And then when it did fail, like, how did it feel?
You know, the story of my involvement in Quibi is I had finished my years at Snapchat and I was sort of contemplating the next chapter of my life. And honestly, I imagined that maybe I would do something outside of tech entirely. I'd spent at that point, you know, 25 years or something making software. And I thought it might be really interesting to spend my next 20 years doing something completely new and different. The list of things that I thought I might try, the only thing they had in common were they're all things that I know nothing about. I was like, maybe I'll become a pastry chef. Maybe I'll become a landscape photographer. Maybe I'll, you know, write a book. Maybe I'll, you know, a whole bunch of things, none of which I have any proven talent at. And when I was in the middle of that and pretty, at least on paper, pretty devoted to that path, I got a call from Meg and Jeffrey who were starting to build the team that would ultimately build Quibi. And I was living in Los Angeles and it just seemed like, gosh, this really isn't a meeting that you turn down. Like, so just such an interesting chance to.
I got a call from Meg and Jeffrey. Like, who gets to say that, right?
Yes, exactly. And I certainly not an everyday occurrence for me.
Yeah.
And so I went to lunch with them. I heard the pitch. They told me about what they wanted to do. And, you know, I left the meeting uninterested in getting involved, mostly because I just had these other ideas about how I was going to spend the next 20 years of my life and they weren't making, you know, another, you know, media streamer. So to make a long story short, every few months they would reach out again. We'd have lunch. I'd decline their offer until late in 2017, 18, late in 2018, I guess. I had lunch one last time with them and they said, look, you know, we brought in somebody to lead product and we brought in someone to lead engineering. And for reasons completely unrelated to Quibi, they both have had to leave the company. We've raised all this money. We've told the world that we're going to launch this thing in about a year. And we could, you know, we could really use your help getting it off the ground. You know, would you be willing to come in for a few days a week to help us while we find someone who actually wants the job? So I said, look, okay, I'll do it. So I started going in on like Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and pretty soon I was showing up on Thursday as well. And then, you know, all week long, and then the weekends too. And sort of before we knew it, I think everybody had forgotten that I didn't actually work there. And ultimately we just sort of codified it as a full-time gig. And you know, there's certainly something kind of painful and embarrassing about being involved in something that was such a spectacular disappointment, failure. But I'm incredibly grateful for the experience, because in some ways I like fell in love with building software again. I got to work with a bunch of really brilliant people. We got to build a platform from scratch using all new technology. And it reignited in me this enthusiasm for the work that I had spent my whole career. And in some ways, I think it also informed my interest in being a CEO for the first time. Yeah. So it's another one of those things that on the surface looks like, you know, gosh, you probably wouldn't do that again if you got the chance. And I think I probably would, just given the great things that it did for me sort of personally. You know, the story of why Quibi wasn't successful, I think, is sort of multidimensional. Sure. There's this piece that we launched the company on April 6th, 2 weeks after, you know, a global lockdown began. I mean,
you know what people didn't want right then? They didn't want short form content. They also didn't want FOMO. My book came out in May of 2020. People are like, I don't have FOMO right now. So I feel you. I really understand this problem.
Yeah. So now, you know, to be fair, TikTok enjoyed a tremendous ascent in popularity during the pandemic. And so I don't think we can entirely lean on the idea that no one was interested in, you know.
I'd prefer to feel safe with you on that one, but I get your point. Yeah, it's like, oops, we forgot about TikTok. All right.
Yeah. I think if there was maybe a miscalculation, and actually there were a number, I'm sure. One was simply that I think we, you know, the idea for the entire notion for the platform is, wouldn't it be interesting to create a medium that is purpose-built for the phone, that leverages the storytelling power of like the Hollywood apparatus. You take, you know, the people who make movies, give them a platform that's like, that's fundamentally designed for the phone, and like, let's see what they can do with that medium. It's short form, it's vertical, it's interactive. That was kind of the big vision. And, you know, I think, the thing that proved sort of untenable in some ways was everything I just described required bespoke content just for Quibi. And so Quibi had to underwrite the creation of all of the content. And depending on how you evaluate what Quibi built, it's either really, really impressive or obviously insufficient. Mm-hmm. It's really impressive from the standpoint that the company made, I think, between 70 and 100 shows for launch, which is more output than all of the major broadcast networks combined in a year. But so through that lens, it's pretty impressive what this startup sort of achieved. But I think where the miss was is that to satisfy the incredibly broad tastes of the, you know, the mobile video consuming universe, you need a lot more content than 100 shows. And so there was a mismatch, I think, between the amount of investment it was going to take to deliver something really, really compelling for a broad swath of consumers and the investor appetite for underwriting the creation of that content. And then, of course, I think that we probably the part that in some ways sits the most uncomfortably with the way that I'm inclined to start a product endeavor. I think it's best to start with some humility and to serve your fledgling audience as best you can and sort of grow with them. Certainly that's what we did at Pandora. And, you know, the model for Quibi was much more the sort of Hollywood blockbuster movie. It's coming on Friday night and everyone needs to show up because it's going to blow your mind, which is sort of the way the product was positioned. And it's just hard to live up to that unless, you know, you're able to do something that's fantastically differentiated on day one, which is really hard in software.
Yeah, everybody's got it out for you. I mean, everybody had it out for Quibi, and then they all feasted on the carcass because people in Hollywood just like doing that, right?
FOMO. FOMO.
One thing we talk about in the show is post-traumatic growth. It's like when something bad happens, do you stay in a place of post-traumatic stress, you revert to normal, or do you come out ahead? The way we started this conversation was about you finding, you know, totally refocusing on your health, and now you're the CEO of Xero. Which, you know, some people may know, I can guarantee, knowing who listens to the show, we have some very, very sort of committed users of Xero. But for those who haven't yet checked it out, tell us about the product. Tell us about, like, what does it cost? How does one use it? All that kind of stuff. Give us that thumbnail sketch of what Xero is.
Yeah. So Xero is a digital coach that helps you form healthy habits that will help you live a longer and healthier life. And our sort of market entry strategy at the founding of the company was to take the habit of intermittent fasting, which you sort of mentioned, but just to, to briefly sort of describe what I even mean by the habit of intermittent fasting. You know, there's all different forms of fasting, of course, through, you know, hundreds of years of human history. But the particular flavor that most of our members deploy in their lives is they have a window where they eat during the day, usually somewhere between 8 to 10 hours, and then they have a window when they don't eat. Most of that period where they're not eating, they're sleeping. So, you know, like a very typical day might look like a member would, you know, have their last meal at 8 o'clock at night, and then not eat again until 10 o'clock in the morning the next day, or maybe noon. And there's all kinds of interesting metabolic things that happen when you stress your body in that way. But setting aside the sort of metabolic impact, the immediate impact that it has on many people's lives is it's a kind of spontaneous caloric restriction. So instead of denying yourself French fries at lunch or an afternoon snack, you eliminate a meal in the morning, you eliminate some sort of like post-dinner snacking. And for lots of people, it's a sustainable way to remove 300, 400, 500, 600 calories from their diet without kind of thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of spontaneous, maintainable caloric, you know, reduction that is just enough to put people first on a path of weight loss and then on a path of like healthy weight maintenance, which is such an elusive thing. That's all without getting into the sort of deep science of what can happen metabolically and cellular restoration and gut health and a whole bunch of other interesting things that come from fasting.
If you want that, there's 1,000 podcasts for that. We want to, we're talking about
there's 1,000 podcasts.
There's so many, probably a Quibi show too. So
yeah.
But we'll skip that for today. It's,
so we definitely don't need to go deep on that. And so, you know, we build an app that kind of makes a game out of forming that habit. You know, we teach you about the benefits and the mechanism. We sort of motivate you through challenges and prompts, and then we reward your progress with gamification, you know, badges and trophies and streaks and all those kinds of things, delightful things that give you a little bit of, you know, reward today for something that pays off in the long term. And, you know, we've built a really fun business around this over the course of the last few years with, you know, millions of people on the platform and a really strong and growing subscriber community. The product is available in a sort of freemium formulation, feature reduced version of the offering. And then you can upgrade to a $69 a year subscription that has more features and more content and more motivation vectors and so forth. And, you know, it's a real fun community of people who are trying to take control of their health and longevity.
Yeah. That's a very specific type of person. I mean, that I joke about the FOMO sapiens, but people who are FOMO sapiens are people who want to make the most out of their days. And that means, and also curious and open-minded. So that's why, as I mentioned, I've been doing this stuff now. I was talking with Tom before we started the interview. I just flew back from Sao Paulo last night, landed this morning, and I took a nap. So that's why I'm sharp right now. But I had lunch with a great entrepreneur who runs a shoe company in Brazil called Yool, Y-U-O-O-L. And he's a fantastic product and he's doing really well. And he's a total FOMO sapiens. And so we were having lunch, delicious Milanese at the shopping in Guatemi. And he said to me, he started talking about his intermittent fasting habit and how much he loves the app that he uses. He showed me Zero and I was like, you're not going to believe who I'm talking to on Friday. And so I wrote him this morning and I said, do you have any question that you would like to ask Tom? And so this is the question from Eduardo Rocha Abishekar, the CEO of Yool. And it is this. Ready? Okay, Tom. Obviously, you have a product with an excellent value proposition and a growing user base. What are your plans for profitability? In terms of strategy, do you prefer to have a lot of users and then upsell or sell the product up front? Thank you. This is good, right, Eduardo?
I mean, this is a great question and boom, so relevant.
Big things coming out of Brazil right now.
Yeah. So I came into the company as CEO 2.5 years ago. November of 2021. And you might remember that by, call it March of 2022, 3 or 4 months later, the kind of macroeconomic environment around funding for young companies dramatically changed kind of overnight. We went from this sort of zero interest rate phenomenon, environment to, a much more sort of almost shut down funding environment for young companies. And I think the whole world of startups started to look much more responsibly at the question of how you grow your business, which honestly I felt pretty good about because having lived through the dot-com bubble, the Pandora experience, which let me tell you, we started the company in 2004. There was no one that wanted to put money into digital music for kind of the entirety of our run. It was, not a sexy place to make an investment bet. And so we always ran the company very much on the fundamentals. And so the last couple of years at Zero, we've been very, very focused on what anybody would call unit economics, sort of like the, what do we pay to acquire a new user? And, what is our ability to sort of thoughtfully and responsibly monetize those people over time? Because at the end of the day, we're driven by our mission to help people live longer and healthier lives, but our ability to generate revenue and profit is sort of the oxygen that we breathe that allows us to do that work. And so I'd say we are very, very quantitative in our approach to the question that your friend has raised, which is to say we just look very, very closely at all of the details of like what happens when a person comes into the product, how do we convert them to an engaged user? How do we convert them from engagement to trial for our premium product? How do we convert them from trial to paid? What are the offers that we give them along the way? What do we do to retain them over time? How do we get them to renew in subsequent years? And then similarly, insofar as we do paid user acquisition, we're incredibly fortunate that almost all of the demand for Zero is entirely organic and by word of mouth. And so we, have millions of people who come to us every year that we acquire just on the backs of people's success with the product and the stories that they tell to one another about that. But to augment that, like any company, we are working to sort out how we can use platforms like Meta's advertising platform, or Google's advertising platform, to responsibly acquire new users who might not otherwise hear about us. And so you've got two sides of that equation. You've got the, what does it cost to acquire the initial download? And then how well can you monetize those people? And we've been really, really sort of grinding on that topic for the course of the last 18 months and made incredible progress on it. I'm a pretty, by nature, right-brained person. And, it's been really fun in the context of Zero to like really have my days sort of work that more left-brained quantitative muscle. And it's fun to see how powerful that can be.
I'm also hardcore right brain. Like that's my left brain doesn't do anything. Seriously. But okay. What I love about your answer, and I think for anybody who's an entrepreneur listening right now, is there was a time there have been times in our entrepreneurial ecosystem globally where all of the sort of boom times made it really easy to focus on vanity metrics and like, you know, show and tell metrics like, oh, look how many users we have, people who never going to pay for your product. And, you know, that works sometimes when the tide is high and where there's plenty of, you know, fish to go around for everybody. But when things recede, then you really find out if you have a business or not. And so when you have experience and you've seen this before and you've been burned before, you know, you kind of know to go there anyway. And so you don't necessarily get sucked in as easily. And so like what I'm hearing from Tom is like he already had that phase of his career where he saw the implications of a lack of rigor. And so you just don't do that, you know, in this business. And so it's allowed you to much more easily transition into a time where capital is more scarce. Is that a fair description?
Yeah. For sure. And in some ways, I mean, there's just different styles of entrepreneurship, right? And different moments in the market. But, you know, I think one of the things that was engendered by the sort of ZIRP chapter, which lasted for, you know, a decade, is that it was really perhaps too easy to raise a ton of capital and to use that to kind of irresponsibly grow top line revenue. You know, so you maybe, you know, it looks like you're growing at this incredible pace year over year, but the cost of acquiring those customers is more than, you might ever recoup from them. And, you know, there was a chapter of, you know, of entrepreneurs who came up with an environment who really believed that, you know, like that you would eventually get to a place where you could, you know, fully express the lifetime value of those customers that you acquired irresponsibly and it would turn right side up. You have investors who, you know, would sort of sell that go big or go home kind of mentality. And candidly, I mean, again, just I think because I grew up in that early .com era where that approach would turned out to be so disastrous, it's not the sort of entrepreneurship that I'm inclined to practice. And so in a funny way, I think I actually feel much more comfortable in the post ZIRP, you know, moment. And because I actually came into Xero as CEO, as our founder stepped up into executive chair role, still my partner in this, Mike Mazur, incredible guy, is a great, incredible story that led to the founding of the company. But he passed that baton to me right while every other digital health and wellness company was raising these giant rounds at giant valuations and spending to acquire users. And because we were in the middle of that transition, like we just weren't in market fundraising then. And so I think in some ways it was really lucky that we sat out that moment, because I worry a little that if we had fundraised in that chapter, we might have been sitting on a valuation that we had a lot of work to do to grow into, and maybe a period of kind of irresponsible spending, or at least pressure to spend irresponsibly. And so we didn't ever have to manage through that, because by the time I was fully kind of settled in the CEO seat, the market had changed, and suddenly the style of entrepreneurship that I'm more comfortable with had become the advocated for path by investors.
And ZIRP is zero interest rate. What's the P?
Phenomenon.
I never heard that before, but I was thinking this is very okay. Yeah. So advice to anybody who now did that and needs to pivot and be able to raise more money, just say you're doing AI and you'll be fine. All right.
Sure.
There you go.
FOMO. FOMO.
All right. So, Tom, we're going to move on to our lightning round now. Four quick questions for quick answers. You ready to go?
I'm ready to go. I've never had a quick answer in my life, but I'll do my best.
I know. I mean, listen, I know you can do this. Number one, what's a favorite quote?
Oh, I love the Eames quote, "The details are not the details, they make the product."
Oh, it's amazing. Okay. I never heard that before, and I love it. I love Eames. All right. Number two. Name one book or podcast that every FOMO sapiens should know about.
One book or podcast. You know, there's a book from like the 90s called Crossing the Chasm.
Yes.
That is like a gem of a business book. And I don't read a lot of business books, but there's just a lot of like durable advice in there about how to create a company that services an initial small community of users and sort of branch out from there. I've gone back to that just sort of over and over and over through the years as I think about a way to take an idea and introduce it to the market and to find some success and to grow from that initial seed.
I love that book. I haven't read it, but I remember it. And that's a good one to check out for everybody. Yeah, total classic. Number three, piece of advice you would give to your younger self.
Maybe, you know, kick the breakfast donut habit sooner than at age 54.
I haven't eaten breakfast. I haven't seen breakfast in years. It's a good one. It is good. You know, breakfast, you can have it at lunch if you like the foods.
Sure.
Have it at lunch, but never start with the sweet, right? Always start with the savories.
And I always started with the sweet. I have such a sweet tooth. And unlike you were saying before we started recording that it's not hard for you to skip breakfast, that you hate eating in the morning. And, you know, part of the reason that this protocol is so useful to me is I love to eat in the morning and I have never made a good breakfast choice ever.
I can't even think about food for the first couple hours. All right. Final one. What's your most important memory?
Well, this is such a cliche, but 7 weeks ago, my wife and I had our first kid.
Wow.
I'm 54 years old. I've heard it my whole life from people who are lucky enough to have children. But it is something very special, that moment that you first lay eyes on your first little one. So it's a cliche, but I'll take it.
Is, you know, nobody said that before, so it may be cliche, but you're the first time. All right. So if you want to learn more about Zero, you can head over to zerolongevity.com. If you want to learn more about Tom, head over to his LinkedIn, Tom Conrad. Tom Conrad, CEO of Zero Longevity. Thank you so much for being here.
Been great to do it. Thank you for having me.
FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOsapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis, and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOsapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOsapiens.com.